their public interest obligations to America's kids. Clearly, the rules are on the books, but I think the FCC has not really regulated enough to make sure that individual stations are meeting their obligations. And again, when the marketplace alone is left to decide, kids lose out. And you know, under the 1996 Telecommunications Act, the FCC has a public interest obligation to always evaluate the consequences its decisions will have on children.
Patty Miller, how can people learn more about the issues of children and the influence of media on them?
We encourage the public to go to our website, www.childrennow.org, and we also ask that concerned citizens send a letter to the FCC, which you can do on our website. You want a quick click, you know, a couple quick clicks, and send a letter to the FCC and tell them that you're concerned about what's happening here and that you're concerned that kids' interests be protected. We also encourage the public to send letters to their congressional representatives as well.
Patty, let me ask you a technical matter here because it's always going to come up. How many N's in childrennow.org?
It's two N's, but one word, childrennow.org.
Okay, so that www.childrennow with two N's in the middle, .org.
That's right, and they can send a letter very easily right to the FCC. We've already sent over 1,000 letters, and we know that it's making a difference and we need more letters.
Well, there's another website we want to direct people to as well. It's www.pacifica.org. We have another guest here in the studio, Robert. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll come right back. We'll also be taking listener phone-ins for the better part of the next hour. Do stay with us. This is our continuing, Pacifica Radio's continuing live coverage of the issue of media deregulation, what it means, what it's all about. Stay tuned. Live with you, concluding our day of broadcasting from New York and Berkeley about media deregulation. I'm Mary Brinsky at KPFA, the original Pacifica station, the first community station on the planet in Berkeley, California. Robert Knight joins me from the studios of WBAI in New York. Joining me also here in the studios at KPFA is someone who has a very different angle and interpretation of what goes on with the Federal Communications Commission. His name is Stephen Dunifer. He's a longtime radio activist, founder of Free Radio Berkeley, somebody who designs, develops, and promotes free radio stations on an international basis. And we have one fewer free radio station than we used to, Stephen, right here in our own community. Why don't you tell people out there across the country what happened to your Berkeley 104.1 FM last month?
Well, first of all, to clarify, for the legal record, it's not my station. It's actually Mercy Liberation Radio, which took over after the court injunction was granted against myself and Free Radio Berkeley.
When I say my station, I mean like KPFA is my station.
Right.
I don't own it.
Right.
I mean,
well, yes.
I mean, you want
it. It's a small matter of federal court injunction against myself.
Okay.
Anyway, well, the station was temporary hiatus. They'll probably be back on the air rather soon. They were raided by the FCC several weeks ago with several FCC officials and maybe in the company about 10 or so federal marshals who came in with an arrest warrant for the equipment and essentially arrested the equipment and took it off. I don't know if the transmitter was allowed a phone call from jail or not, but anyway, that's the situation. It's something that we're not unfamiliar with. It's happened numerous times at other stations across the country who have decided the airways actually belong to the people and not waiting for congressional or FCC approval have gone ahead and acted on that basis of free speech, basically.
Now, you guys danced a very elaborate dance for years with the Federal Communications Commission about getting on the air. There was a proposed rulemaking, and there was a rulemaking, and there was a whole bunch of fussing and bothering for years and years about whether there was room in the spectrum for low-power radio. And finally, the FCC under Clinton came down with a decision that, yes, there could be micro-powered radio stations on the dial, but only in very, very isolated communities, most of them. Here in Northern California, for example, in areas with 6 million people, I think there were two granted, one in Healdsburg and one in Lodi, neither of which could be heard very far, and of course none of which were in places like Oakland or San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. I mean, even the few crumbs the FCC gave us in their rulemaking, which created the low-power FM service, were basically swept off the table, more or less, by the National Association of Broadcasters and NPR, who convinced Congress to pass what they, I guess, mockingly called the Broadcast Preservation Act of 1999, which reduced the number of station allocations from approximately 1,000 to, at most, several hundred. And that's true. It's mostly outlying rural communities. It was their issue of claim of spacing. In other words, how close can the stations exist to each other on the dial? It's all right for 50-kilowatt stations to sit basically right next to each other, but somehow 100-watt LPFM can enjoy that same sort of spacing, but has to be sequestered much further away from other stations.
After your station was knocked off the air here in Berkeley, and I said, your station, again, I want to be understood, you don't own it, but you were associated with it, you worked there, et cetera.
Right.
After this station at 104.1 FM was knocked off the air, I did what engineers used to call a field strength survey. I went around the community here where I used to hear 104.1 FM to see if you, in fact, had been interfering with any other station. And all I was able to get intermittently and faintly was some sort of mainstream schlock rock station out of St. Helena, which is way up north in the Napa Valley. So the claim could not be made that 104.1 FM was bothering another radio station signaling.
That's correct. In fact, an engineer who worked for the two commercial stations to either side of 104.1, 103.7, and 104.5 actually said on the public record at the NAB convention on a panel there that in his role as engineer for these two stations, he actually done the same sort of survey that you talked about and found that the same results, that Freedom to Berkeley at that time at 104.1 was not interfering either in a technical manner or even a fiduciary manner with the operation of your station. So, in our opinion, and we have 10 years or so of experience to back this up, we feel that the small low-power stations can coexist, second adjacent with other stations without posing any interference issues whatsoever, as long as the operation is technically clean.
Of course, there was also the issue of content.
Well, there's content.
The
content.
Kind of content that Free Radio Berkeley was putting out was the kind of content that your average FCC commissioner or official would not be comfortable with. It was raw edge, community stuff, free expression, dissent from orthodoxies, music that isn't played anywhere else, all kinds of stuff that you don't hear, to say the least, on commercial radio. You don't even hear it on KPFA.
That's correct, and that's why we felt that, we feel that this type of expression is needed, and given our current situation, it's probably needed even more now. And my feeling is, given the whole, what we've been hearing today and the general context of the greater reality, I just think that, people who wish to engage in trying to reform the system can go ahead, but I believe that we have to go ahead and push the envelope further and put more and more stations on the air. It's safety in numbers. If we could somehow rebuild the movement back, if hundreds and hundreds of more stations go on the air, the FCC does not have the resources to deal with it. I mean, that was the reason they created the low-power FM service in the first place. It was basically they were faced with an ungovernable situation.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
As soon as they would be able to shut down one station, several more would pop up, and then the one they shut down would come back on a month later. So, you know, I wish you all the luck in the world trying to reform and lobby Congress and SEC. But, you know, the wobblies and, you know, have an old saying, direct action gets the goods.
Robert Knight, are you still with us there in New York? I wanted to know if this low-power radio situation was relevant to a densely populated area like New York City and, to some extent, suburban New York as well. Have you heard any stations that have gone on the air there, and what's happened to them?
Well, I'm not familiar with the exactly with the low-power broadcast situation. The most significant issue that I'm aware of in the New York area at this point in time is, of course, the logistics of setting up a transmitter for a college radio station, Fordham University, WFUV, which is moving to an elevated location from its sort of outlying position currently in the Bronx, or it's trying to do so. Going through the FCC process. And this caused an unfortunate competition with WFMU at Uppsala College in New Jersey, both of which have tradition of being so-called college radio stations that used to specialize in the kind of music you could not hear anywhere else.
It's also the issue of erecting a giant radio tower in the otherwise bucolic precincts of the Bronx Botanical Garden, I believe. That's an issue as well. Isn't all this, Stephen Dunifer, isn't all of this dinosaur language? I mean, we hear over and over again, you guys in your transmitters, KPFA, whatever, Radio Berkeley, KGO, matter, are all dinosaurs. You're all going to be superseded by some combination of internet file transmission / satellite. Having an over-the-air transmission on now, either the AM or the FM band, is quickly going to be a thing of the past. You're an engineer. What do you think?
Well, I don't think the technology you mentioned is going to be able to really be a substitute for local community radio. It's just, I mean, we can use those technologies to enhance what we're doing. I mean, for example, 3 years or so ago in Seattle, what came known as the Battle of Seattle, I was part of a group of people that helped together the first independent media center there. And in the ensuing 3 years, that's grown to over 100 independent media centers around the world. But it's using technologies in an appropriate way. I mean, for now, it's now possible using internet streaming technology when demonstrations are going down in Prague or in Genoa or wherever things happen to be going on. That can be streamed over the net, and then, you know, small independent stations, community stations, free stations, whatever, can pick up that stream and rebroadcast in their communities. So they can also, at the same time, be a local station, but through these type of decentralizing technologies, be part of a global network, which is totally controlled and run by the grassroots media people. So I don't see any contradictions between internet, satellite, community radio. If we look at them as integrated whole and see how each part of that technical, you know, puzzle can be put together to create a global grassroots media alternative and network, then I don't see any problems with it. I don't think any one of these technologies is going to make one or the other obsolete, particularly if people use them in a creative, upfront, militant manner.
We have one of the problems with small or micro broadcasts here in New York City and by extension in urban areas throughout the country is that there's a tremendous interference problem or blockage or multiple cross path issues because of the density of edifices, buildings here in New York. However, there have been and continue to be in some neighborhoods so-called pirate radio stations. One of the most famous ones in Greenwich Village, attempted to apply for a license to legitimately broadcast. A similar station in Houston, Texas, converted its broadcast where the land is flatter, where the signal strength can propagate further. In recent years, they converted from a radio transmission broadcast to an internet cast.
We're joined by another guest, somebody who appeared not at great length on the final panel, and we believe he has more to say than he had a chance to say today in the New York Forum that we broadcast earlier for 6 or 7 hours. He is James Joyce, who was one of two union representatives who was there today. James Joyce is vice president of NABIT, and CWA. CWA, full disclosure, represents us, the paid staff here at KPFA and at several other Pacifica stations as well. Welcome, James Joyce, to Pacifica.
Thank you, Larry.
Had you been able to speak more, would you have been able to address the issue, I know you would have, of the tremendous job loss, which I think was mentioned only in passing, that deregulation has brought upon this industry, not only in those of us who sit behind the microphones, but people who engineer the microphones and everything else as well. It's been a disaster for technology jobs, radio jobs in this country.
I certainly would have, especially with what has been NABIT's experience here in New York primarily. I mean, NABIT used to represent, NABIT grew out of the old NBC radio network. Originally, NABIT was called the ATE, the Association of Technical Employees, back in the days of the 30s when radio was king. And NBC is completely out of the radio business now. At ABC,
Wow, that hurt my ears. I don't know about the listeners. I think we lost Mr. Joyce there on that call. We'll get him back.
That's unfortunate because he was speaking of something that might have been for some an unexpected parallel between technical staff and between creative and producer staff. The man from HBO, the producer of Oz, was speaking about how the cross-ownership of networks, of channels, means that a product can be re-syndicated to a subdivision of that corporation at a sweetheart rate. And that plight seems common with the reduced income for the artistic creators and producers to the layoffs and reduction of job leverage that technical workers have when, for instance, as it was spoken of, Fox comes to own Channel 9 and Channel 5 here in New York City and then can therefore streamline or trim or lay off their staff.
James Joyce is back with us. Thank you, Mr. Joyce. Sorry for the technical glitch there.
No problem.
We probably need more NABIT engineers somewhere on the line here.
I'll talk to Kevin Wilson. We'll get a new. We'll get the employer down there and start bargaining for more employees.
Bargaining. Oh yeah. Okay. I've actually been in NABIT and back in my commercial radio past, and I want to say I felt I was very well represented, and we were then at KSAN Metro Media. By NABIT, as I feel CWA has done a great job for us here at KPFA during our troubles with Pacifica. It's always important for people to be able to count on some sort of collective organization when they are in trouble or even when they're not in trouble. And to work a union job in this country is becoming more of a privilege than a right. We have only about 9% of the industrialized workforce that belong to unions anymore. That is shrinking all the time. And as we started to say before, one of the areas of tremendous shrinkage is in this broadcast field. But the area that is of most concern to me about that is something that got mentioned a few times during the forum we broadcast, and that's this thing about voice tracking, where with Clear Channel and other giant corporations, somebody sits somewhere, San Antonio, San Diego, pretends they're in Boise, Idaho, or Peking, Illinois, and says, how you doing out there, and gives certain local references and records 25 or 30 stations worth of supposedly buddy-buddy local guy, and it's not that at all. It's a great big lie. This is really one of the most appalling, but I think symbolic, effects of deregulation.
Well, I'll give you an even more mind-boggling potential example, and that is with the combination of hubbing, and hubbing allows television group owners to run not only master control operations, but television news production from a remote location with a device called Parker Vision, and we believe that there could be some smaller group-owned entities that may try to produce what they're portraying as local television news out of another city. Or the only element that would be in the the target city, and I'll give you an example. In Buffalo, would be a reporter in front of an anchor in front of a blue chroma key wall. All the other production and technical wizardry is being done in Indianapolis somewhere. Again, removing localism and to go to that extent in television, where local news is just a joke, then you know that's the real crime. I mean, there should be as much localism. And I'm concerned, and we haven't seen all the effects here in New York, but I'm concerned that the FCC 20 years ago, and I referred to this in my remarks this afternoon, went to great pains to make sure that one of the major New York City television stations was located to New Jersey. At one point, it was almost the ABC station, but RKO General moved WOR to Secaucus, New Jersey, and now, by virtue of granting Fox a duopoly, the only aspect of the WWOR operation that is remaining in New Jersey is a master control operation and a hubbing operation for other cities. The news crews now report to New York. There'll be the assignment desk is based in New York, so where they did try to slant when the whole station was based in New Jersey, a very strong local New Jersey angle, I believe that will completely disappear, and that serves as an injustice to the goals the commission set up when they tried to locate a VHF commercial television station within the state of New Jersey.
Wow. So is this regulated? I mean, you know, a lot of things were sloshing around today in this very ill-defined forum. It was not at all a legal proceeding or even a commission proceeding. And one of the things that was most unclear, I think, in my mind, and I'm sure in listeners' minds, is the difference between law and rules. This was alluded to in the opening statement by Michael Powell, who was concerned that he be seen as a relatively powerless person. Oh, the courts determine what I can do, and I just sit around here and shuffle papers and do what the courts tell me to. Or Congress tells me what I can do, and we here at the commission just kind of are, you know, their minions or something like that, which, as far as I can tell over the course of history, is not at all true. But what is true is that there's a vast struggle that goes on between rulemaking, lawmaking, and enforcement of either on the part of the government. What would you like to see ideally done, James Joyce, from the point of view of NABIT and CWA, as far as either legislation or rulemaking or enforcement of rules and laws to counter what we've been talking about here?
Well, I think the first thing that has to be done, and Congressman Nadler, who is present in the audience this morning, Jerry represents the Upper West Side of Manhattan. One of the points he talked to me about off the record was, or at least not as official part of the proceeding, was the fact that he can't get any of his legislative agenda initiatives noticed by the local press. That the only issue that the press wants to cover with Jerry Nadler is the fact that he had his stomach stapled and has lost 60 pounds. And Jerry is a true voice of a progressive legislature. I mean, he is someone that we need more Jerry Nadlers in Congress. And I think the rest of Congress has to be made aware of the fact that they are not going to get their legislative agendas noticed by the local press to the extent that they should be. So, number one, making Congress aware that, you know, if they want good work to be achieved, that it's going to be a big burden just to have someone take notice of them. Should be our first objective, both organized labor and the community at large. Legislatively, there's a lot of issues that have to be looked at, and I think that more has to be done at looking at the campaign finance aspects of broadcasting. Certainly, I think people should be very concerned that if deregulation comes about and leads to more media concentration, especially in major markets, that it is going to make it extremely difficult for small political candidates to get their message out through advertising. Another aspect, and I've just been trying to raise the level of perception within CWA, with respect to campaign finance and the campaign contributions is the large media companies make political contributions to political candidates that they think will serve those business interests. In turn, those political candidates, and maybe it's not a quid pro quo, but they certainly end up buying time on stations where the parent company has made a political contribution. So an argument really could be made that some of these media companies are really providing free advertising because they push the money out and the money comes right back in to candidates that they're supporting ideologically. And I think that something has to be done at that, whether that is a ban on political candidates from buying time on outlets that have contributed to their campaign, or a ban on media outlets making certain types of political contributions, I'm not sure. But it does seem to me that there's a basic inequity there, that some candidates, if they get the attention of the Walt Disney Company or Viacom, really are ending up with free political advertising time.
James Joyce, I want to thank you very much for being with us on this particular broadcast. I'm the Vice President of NABIC and CWA.
Thank you, Larry. Pleasure being here.
All right. Robert Knight is with us still in New York, and also joining us from New York is KPFA's own Hard Knock Radio Zone, Davey D, the program heard here from 4 to 5 every afternoon. Davey D used to be in commercial broadcasting, as indeed did I. We both had our troubles, mine many years back with commercial broadcasters, getting fired by them. Davey's is much more recent than mine. And Davey, I know you've talked about this. You worked for KMEL, which was one of those stations owned by the giant dread conglomerate. And you got into trouble because of things you said on the air, despite the fact that you'd been on the air for how many years?
Well, I don't know. I was there 11 years.
11 years at KMEL, yeah. Which was, for want of a better word, a hip-hop station in the Bay Area. Davey's in New York right now. Davey, if you wouldn't mind, because I think our New York listeners probably don't know about this, if at all, and our California listeners may not know this because you don't talk about it all the time. Just lay out what exactly happened to you that at least temporarily terminated your career as a commercial broadcaster.
Well, the official word is that they had to make budget cuts. Reading between the lines, what we were talking about was I had a pretty well-listened-to talk show and gave a lot of people access to the airwaves. And I think what folks were putting two and two together was the fact that I had beaten pretty much every broadcast in the country to having an interview with Barbara Lee after she did the no vote. Not only did we have her on the air, like the day after, or a couple of days after, but we had transcribed that interview and sent it out all over the place. And it was maybe about a week or so later that I was called in, and they were saying, look, we have to make these budget cuts, and myself, and then I guess there were nine other people they let go, were suddenly let go. And it caused an uproar, primarily because what had happened was you were looking at a situation where I was in good standing with them. There was never a problem, never a debate, or never any sort of contentious relationship. However, we were talking about a time when the station itself had stopped playing music and was just opening up the phone lines and giving people the space to talk about things. The problem was is that we're talking about a station that reaches the mostly African-Americans, the larger communities of color, and the perspectives that were being felt in those neighborhoods definitely weren't being felt in on the airwaves in terms of looking at, say, the discrimination and the attacks on the Muslim students or Muslim people of Muslim background. You didn't have any sort of conversation about what may have led up to those attacks. So we had people basically towing the party line. And so my show was definitely a beacon for people who had these other perspectives and sentiments, and I had no problem granting people that airtime and those in that space to offer another perspective. Keeping in mind that we're talking about the fourth largest media market in the country, and we're talking about a station that influences the rest of the country in terms of how it approaches things. So I don't think it was just budget cuts. I don't think it was that coincidental that all after 9/11, 2 weeks afterwards, they have budget cuts after we have these conversations that nobody else was having, where definitely a lot of people were taking notice and a lot of people were looking. The way they went about doing it was such that they didn't even say, take your last goodbyes, or why don't you go on in.
You never get a chance to say goodbye on the air. I learned that a long time ago. They're going to fire you. They're going to fire you without you having the last say. That's for sure.
But for us, that's not been the case.
Davey, can you tell us what your
chance to say to do those sort of things, and that's what made it suspicious.
I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Sure, I can.
Oh, okay. Sounds like you're in a kind of a noisy place. You're in New York right now. We want to let you go, but we want you to describe briefly here what the grassroots effort to gain access to the media that you're involved in that brought you to New York, and how it might relate to the forum that we've been broadcasting here all day today on Pacific about the FCC and deregulation.
Well, there's two things that's going on. One, there's been a lot of conversation within the hip-hop community and the black community at large about the state of radio. It hits on two curves. One curve is that the type of music that's being played seems to segregate large components of the community, people who are quote-unquote older, and we're talking like maybe 30-plus, and then the content of the music that's being played. That's one side of it. Then you have situations all around the country where people who are local have no access whatsoever to the commercial entities, and it weighs pretty heavily because a lot of black folks and people in the hood, so to speak, don't listen to college or community radio in large numbers. They tend to support the urban stations in their area, and they, you know, generally speaking, you're talking about a habit that's just ingrained for people for, you know, for literally generations, in my opinion. So what you're finding is that you have this absence of all this type of information and perspective musically, and now you're starting to have people grumble, and they're starting to raise up and do something. On Tuesday night, when I was out here, Bob Law, who's a popular radio host, and a number of other people from Vaughn Harper, another radio guy, to old-time singers like Ray Goodman and Brown, and people from the Manhattans, as well as Afrika Bambaataa, Chuck D. Packed House came out to talk about what they felt was a segregation of the a censoring of the music. Positive music is not played in New York City. And you have a few gatekeepers who are making these decisions and excluding a lot of folks, and it's having what people perceive to be a devastating effect. So the promise and the commitment after that meeting was to first of all have a follow-up and try to really make this a national scenario, because the same complaints that they were having in New York and talking about that night, we have in San Francisco, which resulted in a report being put out about KML. It's the same type of situation that took place in Detroit last year against another Clear Channel station where a lot of the local people had no access to the airwaves. Same thing in Chicago, same thing in Seattle. And so what it is that because you only have one or two media outlets, people don't know that these things are going on, and I think people are now starting to realize the same problem is taking place all over the country.
And they can find out.
Trying to connect the dots.
And they can find out about that at your website, which is one of the most visited and, as far as I'm concerned, valuable website on questions like these. Why don't you give out that URL, David?
It's davyd.com, D-A-V-E-Y-D.com. And if you go there today, there's a pretty good article called Hip Hop's Ultimate Battle. It says race and the politics of divide and conquer, and it deals with the situation with radio, the scenario that took place with black radio being co-opted by CHR radio in terms of playing hip-hop and what's happening with that. So if people want to see something that really gives some insight, I would suggest to look at that article.
I would, David, this is Robert Knight, and it's great to have you in New York, and I must tell you how proud I am to be involved in the transition between Flashpoints and your excellent Hard Knock Radio. Two more reasons why people ought to be calling or hitting Pacifica.org to support these kinds of programs. It's really an honor to be talking with you.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us, Davey D. Once again, thank you for bringing that up, Robert Knight, because we do need to stress that. And while people are joining us to express their opinions or ask questions, Robert and I will be here for another half hour or so. at our toll-free nationwide number, 1-800-958-9008. Stephen Dunifer is still in the studio with us here if you have any questions about low-power alternative community broadcasting. Hello?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one quick thing today, if you have a second.
Just about, because we're going to go off the air in 20 minutes. What's up?
Okay, well, I'll tell you off air, because the same conversation has been taking place at the Wall Street Project with Jesse Jackson, and Michael Powell was actually here today. And I wanted to encourage people, because I actually had a conversation with him, to at least start writing letters. I think people might overlook it and think it's a waste of time, but the conversation I had with him led me to believe that he may start into some of these conversations and arguments that people are having, and it can't hurt at the very least. You know, a letter, a perspective, shared with your community youth, there's an open letter to educate people, but I think that should be something that we doing as we try to get the tide to turn in terms of what the FCC is doing.
David, would you mind putting a link up on your website so if people go there and read that interesting article, which I've already read about Black Radio, www.davyd.com, if you would just put up a way of sending a letter to Commissioner Powell of the FCC, I think it would be a great service.
I will do that probably later tonight.
All right.
Everything's been evacuated where I'm at, so I got to leave.
All right, be safe. Davy D in New York. He'll be back here with us in Berkeley before too long, we hope. Our toll-free telephone number for you to ask questions or make statements. Stephen Dunifer is still here with us. Robert Knight from New York. And let's see, somebody's dial tone is with us, too. Our toll-free number is 1-800-958-9008. And before we take our calls, I want to stress once again, Robert, that we do need money to keep this kind of broadcast going. If people appreciate the fact that you and I have been at it since, I don't even want to remember, 8-9 hours ago, we hope to do these kind of broadcasts again. The FCC is having another hearing in February in Richmond, Virginia. www.pacifica.org is the website where you could make a secure pledge. A lot of people have called
on. And we stand on the shoulders of giants, including our technical staff, the producers, and the dedicated volunteers that make a free-spirited, non-encumbered Pacifica Radio possible. On top of that, we have what I believe to be the most intelligent and ethical audience in radio, and that is why I feel confident about simply mentioning the website, pacifica.org. And knowing that people will take the incumbency upon themselves to support that which they need, that which it's an illusion that you can listen for free. It's true for a little while, but when the bills come due, that's when our listeners keep us independent with contributions at Pacifica.org.
And that's when people tell us, you and Robert want to do another one of these broadcasts? We didn't pay for the last one yet. www.pacifica.org. We were asked, a number of people have called up and said, we don't have the web, we want to write. If you want to send a contribution, it's tax deductible, $25, $50, $100 would really help. Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'll say that again slowly now, and I'll mention it again later. Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Jane from New York is our first caller in this segment. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Let me turn the radio down.
Oprah Radio
lives in a big house, huh?
Oprah Radio is not in Westchester.
It isn't. It's in the heart of Manhattan.
The radio is obviously in a different zip code.
Right. Intelligent, ethical, and imaginative. I like that, too.
Good point, imaginative.
The comment that I wanted to make is that it seems to me that there might be organizing space and linkage between the challenge to the corporation as being worthy of free speech and the corporation as censor. Because this morning, I think it was the .org guy, the former commissioner, who laid out the fact that the...
You mean Nicholas Johnson.
Yeah. Like the broadcasters they can censor. They can, because they have free speech rights, they can accept content, but they can also reject it. But the analog is the same the same with corporations with free speech rights can censor, can silence their workers as well because they don't have free speech in the workspace. And there's a the whole issue, that whole issue of the corporation as a as an individual and therefore worthy of free speech is being challenged recently. I don't know if people, I heard about it this morning with a recent case against Nike. And it just seems to me that there's a real linkage there, that there's some space for organizing to challenge the corporation because corporations don't, it isn't free speech, it's bottom line, and the bottom line isn't free. I mean, that's just a, you know, way of, but it just seems that there's linkage there, and that what that can do is to make these issues less discreet. In other words, if you challenge the corporation in terms of free speech and therefore being able to censor its workers, to say that workers should have free speech wherever they are, people should have free speech wherever they are, that begins to create a base, a free speech base of people who are freely speaking. And at any rate, it just seemed to me that there was a real, that there could be a real connection there. And I even have a slogan, which is, democracy knows no bottom line. So that's what I have to say.
That's a good
one.
That's
excellent. I think your statement is so cogent that it needs no enhancement. But I will advise or suggest to people within our institution that that issue of removing that concept of the legal fiction of the corporation, that as things develop on a legal front on that, that the Pacifica.org website keep people abreast of that, as well as our broadcast.
Fred in Houston is our next caller. Hi, Fred.
How you guys doing?
We're hanging in there. A little tired, in my case.
Glad you're with us. Feeling great.
Thank you very much. There is a saying that I picked up a few years ago, basically to the extent that if you ever want to figure out why something is the way it is, you follow the money. And I thought that your listeners would be interested to hear that while you all have been talking about the consolidation, prior to the Telecom Act of 1996, the FCC did allow a limited amount of consolidation in the broadcast ownership arena, and that was that radio stations were allowed to own two stations in the same service. In other words, you could have two FMs or two AMs in a market, for example. But there were very strict guidelines to make sure that one owner didn't overwhelm the community. You couldn't own every radio station in the market, which unfortunately in some cases now exists.
Yeah, but Fred, this is part of a very sad progression, because I remember back, and Stephen Dunifer, maybe you remember back, when in the 70s, radio station owners could not own more than one, either an FM or an AM. Then it came that you could own one AM and one FM as long as 75% of the programming on one or the other was independent of the first station. And then the slippery slope, which you're talking about, Fred, became two and two, and then it became three and three. And now it can become, you know, a huge portion of every market. Once
the point I want to make is that the FCC, and a lot of people lay the blame at the commission, but Congress modified the method by which market coverage was determined. And this was something Congress did, not the commission.
Well, that's a good point, and it's something Congress is going to have to reverse if it's going to get reversed.
Fred, do you think there's any relationship then between campaign contributions? A short while ago, we were mentioning that in the 2002 cycle, that the media industry donated $44 million to campaign candidacies. And you say follow the money, so I suppose that is one place to start sniffing around.
I think he's on a car phone, Robert. I think he faded away. We're going to go to Paul in Los Angeles. Maybe he's on a landline. Hi, Paul.
Yes, hello. Well, as we've experienced, I'm talking about listeners of experience, and we just heard, is it Danny D? Did I get the name right?
Davey D.
There's extreme censorship on the mainstream media, but you, Larry, you cut off people who disagree or criticize you very quickly. That's censorship, too.
I'm not aware of doing that. You're one of the few people who say that I have done that. But I tell you what, Paul, I'll cut you off right now and go to another caller
there
just to prove your point. Who's our next caller? You're on the air long enough and often enough, you get them all coming back at you over and over again. Our next caller is... who? Fred is back with us? He came back? He got in? Hi, Fred.
I am back. I did pay my cell phone bill.
Okay, in between. That's a fast payment. How did you get it paid so fast? 2 minutes.
Credit card. We live off plastic down here.
Okay.
Well, again, getting back to the point is that follow the money. And I cannot believe that campaign contributions didn't have a lot to do with it. I do a number of things. I'm a broadcast engineer in the Houston area. I've been in radio for 34 years. I also have ownership interests in stations outside of this area. So I kind of see both sides of it. Here in Houston, we've had the same amount of consolidation as everybody else. And one of my clients is the last independently owned FM that serves the Houston market. And I feel very, very proud to be associated with them. With respect to Congress, here's another interesting thing to consider. Every week, there are people that file comments with the FCC to change the FM table of allocations. That means that new FM frequencies have been allocated or dropped into communities all through the country. These frequencies are sitting around waiting to be auctioned off to the highest bidder. And back 2 years ago, the commission...
Fred, I really don't want to go into the niceties and the exigencies of the FCC and frequencies, if it's okay with you. Stephen Dunifer is here in the studio, however. He studied this stuff over the years about getting frequencies. The fact of the matter is, Stephen, that there aren't any frequencies that a person could apply for from the FCC and have any reasonable expectation of getting in a major market, are there?
None any major markets. I mean, your only option is to buy a high leverage station at this point. They just don't exist.
Kevin in Santa Monica is our next caller. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. Thank you very much. I'm very happy that you guys are running this program. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I've been following it for a good part of the day. I just had a couple of observations. I was listening to a lot of the different panels that came up. There were a few statements that got made on those panels, particularly by Dave Poltrek, that I felt were way off from the truth. They were way off from reality. And one of them, in the last panel, there was a person who tried to make the comment, I'm not talking about out of the Pacifica group, I'm talking about the people that were actually at the meeting, who said that, quote, vertical integration was a disaster for ABC and for Disney, which is complete nonsense. Vertical integration for any of these companies is actually a tremendous profitable success for them. And it's amazing that they can make a statement like that. It's almost a bald-faced lie. With Poltrek, there were multiple things that he kept stating over and over again, 102 channels, and not hearing the fact that there may be 102 channels, but there's only a few owners who actually manage all of those different channels. So that, in fact, there's really only a few viewpoints and a few philosophies that are being filtered over all of those channels.
As we said at the beginning of the program, the more we can communicate, the less can be said under the corporate paradigm of communications. And you speak about vertical integration. We, as a national community, only narrowly missed yet further mergers between the ABC News operation and AOL Time Warner. So it never ends.
It never ends at CNN. ABC is still somewhere percolating. It may still happen. Eli in Palo Alto is our next caller and perhaps our final one. No, we got a little more time. 1-800-958-9008 is our toll-free number. People
and the way to support this kind of populist radio and ability to do a significant, well-ordered national program with a well-ordered conference such as the Media Ownership one at the Kernighan Center at the Columbia Law School is to go to the website of this network, this People's Network, Pacifica.org, and do your supportive duty.
www.pacifica.org. Pledge some money. Pay for this broadcast so we can perhaps do another one. Eli in Palo Alto, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Just a couple of comments. One, thank you so much for airing this.
You're welcome.
Two, I was really impressed by some of the comments of the panelists who were essentially biting the hands that feed them. In particular, Richard Mazur, who is a character actor and was head of SAG. Tom Fontana, who's an extremely successful TV producer. And then you had the Madison Avenue guy who, you know, they're risking, you know, I wouldn't say they're risking their livings, but, I mean, I think they're extremely brave individuals, you know, to be able to, you know, confront the FCC and say, you know what, despite the fact that it looks like we'll benefit from this, no, we won't. that surprised me. I also want to ask a question. I wasn't able to hear all of the broadcasts because, of course, I'm at work, had to go to a meeting. Has anyone attempted to tie this in to the Supreme Court decision yesterday on the Eldred case and the squeezing of content and copyright and the encroaching loss of the public domain? It seems like we're getting it from all sides. We're being restricted in what we can access in the content and how we can access it via media distribution.
That didn't come up that I heard, Robert. I think I heard pretty much every word of it, but it did come up in my mind as I was reading that yesterday that did have to do with this, that it is part of an officialistic, legalistic mindset which restricts people's content access.
Of course, the gathering storm of a person's right to use in whatever mode that which one legitimately possesses, and the restrictions on media, by media I mean whether you listen to a song on your computer or whether you listen to it on your stereo at home or elsewhere, that is a very important storm, a very important issue to be confronted. Even more, I think, and this is sort of straddling the domain of FCC regulation, is the software conglomeration that is taking place, particularly with a corporation like Microsoft, which has propagated an operating system that monitors one's activities with media, such as films and songs that one may listen to on one's computer. And there is, I believe, an analogous control system developing in the utilities, the ways that one can use a computer to communicate, that mirrors what we've been seeing in broadcast and in broadband. I think the caller is making a very salient point here.
Sarah in Brooklyn is going to be our last caller. Sarah, can you get it done in 60 seconds?
60 seconds, probably not, but this is sort of a tribute to WBAI. BAI remains probably the only station east of the Mississippi to have, well, first of all, I say, somebody called and said you hear music all the time, you tune in, but the one thing you do hear all the time is religious programming. But BAI has instituted a sort of balance to that. We have a program called Equal Time for Free Thought, and it's something that's long overdue because the religiosity is really all-pervasive, and we absolutely have to have some fresh air. And so I hope people do tune in 6:30 on Sunday night to WBAI and hear our program and phone us.
Well, I'd like to say amen to that.
Amen. And goodness bless you.
Bless all of you. Bless you, listeners. Bless you, Robert Knight. Bless you, Stephen.
I'm Robert Knight in New York. That's Larry Binsky in Berkeley.
We're going to say goodbye now. I have a lot of people to thank here. But before we do, please, folks, if you appreciate this broadcast, www.pacifica.org. A small tax-deductible donation, or even a large one, would be most welcome in encouraging us to do this kind of thing again.
And we are prepared to recycle corporate money if they'd like to make a tax-deductible donation.
As long as you can pay it, we can take it. Pacifica Radio,
no
you
stream.
Can also write to us, yes. 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We want to thank Haley Miller and Tony McLeod and Alan Crosswell at Columbia University for facilitating this broadcast today at WBAI, starting with station manager Don Rojas. Welcome to him. Matthew Finch, Michael G. Haskins, Gratian Challenger, Errol Maitland, and Robert Knight. Pacifica in Washington, Verna Avery Brown for her invaluable assistance. Here at KPFA, our producer has been Stephanie Hendricks. Our technical producer has been Mickey Mays. Thanks also to Lewis Sawyer and Anastasia, and especially to Jim Bennett, who put all of this together technically in a magnificent way. Thank you, Robert Knight. It's been great working with you again. I'm Larry.
Very proud of, it. Good for you, Larry.
All right. We'll be back. Thank you all for your support. also to mention to those of you listening that we will be covering rallies in Washington and in San Francisco this coming Saturday, starting at 8 a.m. Pacific time, 11 a.m. New York time, and going all day long. Those peace rallies, anti-war rallies, extremely important and also part of our mission. Stay tuned. Do tune in.
Larry, I'd like to just add that those listening to this stream from Pacifica, that Peace Watch will be heard immediately following the conclusion of this program. Now the control is back in our hands here at WBAI. I want to let you know that, yes, do make your pledges at pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. We had to make some necessary shifts and rearrangements to facilitate this full day of programming covering the FCC hearings at Columbia Law School in Manhattan, and we thank those producers who made way for us to bring you this very, very important information that is so valuable to us, those of us who listen to the radio. And thank you all for tuning in, those of you who have joined us from earlier in the day. Thanks to Robert Knight and to Mary Bensky for hosting this program. Certainly, all of the engineers here in New York, Errol Maitland, producer Matthew Finch, Grayson Challenger, chief technical operator here at WBAI, and Jim Bennett in California. We'd like to encourage you to stay tuned throughout the evening into the overnights, because coming up in a few minutes will be a report of the day's news with the WBAI news team, Free Speech Radio News at 6:30 p.m. And at 7 o'clock, Education at the Crossroads with Basir M. Chawi, Where We Live with Sally O'Brien and Sophia Bukhari, and also Rosa Clemente, Afri Kaleidoscope with Alambe Brath, and we'll be looking at the Congo yet again. We thank him for that, and 10 p.m., Heart of Mind with Kathy Davis, and at 11 p.m., New York time, Eastern Standard Time, 11 p.m., will be Pacifica Radio's Peace Watch. And at midnight, on a Thursday night into a Friday morning, Radio Unnameable with Bob Fass. It's 5:58 in New York City, and you're tuned to 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, Radio WBAI. In a minute or two, a report of the day's news with the WBAI news team. From Master Control in New York, I'm Michael G. Haskins.
ماشین نظامی ایالات متحده آمریکا جهت حمله به عراق نیروهای خود را فعالانه سازمان می‌دهد. مارتین لوتر کینگ می‌گفت در زمانی که انسان‌های خوب ساکت بمانند، اهریمن‌ها پیروز می‌شوند. ما نبایستی ساکت در حاشیه بنشینیم در حالی که مالیات‌های پرداختی ما تحت لوای جنگ با ترور صرف خرید ابزار جنگی می‌شود که به وسیله آن مردان، زنان و کودکان بیگناه عراق را به خاک و خون بکشانند. در 18 ژانویه به راهپیمایی گروه رفراندوم مردمان ضد جنگ و صدها هزار انسان خشمگین ضد جنگ دیگر که از سراسر کشور در واشنگتن گرد هم می‌آیند در محل نیروی دریایی بپیوند و به حمله عراق جواب منفی بده.